Welcome to the Theology of the Buddy, a podcast for Catholics who love the beauty of the church's sacred tradition. This is episode 93. My name is Chris, longing for burgers all through Lent. It's true. If you're looking to grow in the faith in new ways, looking to connect with other faithful Catholics who are committed to helping you grow closer to our blessed Lord, or you're simply looking for other Catholic voices who are willing to speak the truth without compromise and who like to have a little fun in the process, you've come to the right place. We're not experts, but have learned a lot over the 15 plus years we've been friends in the faith, and we want to share that smash burger of friendship with you. So if you haven't yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening to ensure you get the best amazing alliterations as soon as they air. Don't forget to drop by theologyofthebuddy.com for all of our show notes and past episodes. While you're at it, don't forget to follow us on social media so you can keep up to date with all of the great content we are sending out. You can find us at Stay Traddy on Twitter and at Theology of the Buddy on Instagram and Facebook. So on this episode, we are diving in, the three of us, myself, Mike, and Tim, we're diving into a bit of a book review / conversation about the awesome book by Father Revoir.
Do you know if I was Mr. Revoir, what I would have named my son?
No.
It wouldn't have been Reginald Marie. It would have been Owen. Do you know why?
No, jeez.
Because then if he used his first initial, he'd be au revoir.
Au revoir.
Wow.
Oh, and that's a wrap. Podcast.
That's it. That's
Thank you for
joining us today on Theology of the Buddy. We hope you enjoyed that joke.
There's going to be a lot more. We know that's happening.
Here's another one. As you can tell, we don't have a script for this episode, but we do have a rescript.
Wow. I hope our good friend Dr. Stein is listening. I'm sure he would love this. I miss you, Dr. Stein, by the way. You look great.
Say, come hang out with us sometime.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Agreed. So yeah, we're going to talk about, does Traditionis Custodis pass the juridical rationality test? But you might be thinking, is this a book that was written prior to the rescript that was recently released by Cardinal Arthur Roach? But I think it is still absolutely pertinent, and it still stands in the argument. So, but before we do that, I wanted to share my moment of a glitch in the matrix with our listeners, but particularly Tim. It was unreal today. I legit called Brooke afterwards and I had to confirm I wasn't in a simulation. So I'm at work and like my job is like very boring and it attracts very boring people and myself included. And so right before the end of the day, all of our systems crashed. And so I stood up and I was talking to one of my neighbors in the cubicle across from me. And for some reason, we got onto the topic of where she was from. And she goes on to tell me that she attends the church where Mike and Brooke and I and Julie all met. And so I was like, I was flabbergasted because I was like, I thought you looked familiar. She admits to me that her husband plays in the 11 o'clock band for mass, at which point I'm like, cringe. She still says, or she's actually a non-denominational Protestant, but her husband's Catholic. And she says to me, because of my Protestant upbringing, I just really appreciate the modern music at mass. And I died on the inside, just died. But then we get like, you can't see this on the video. We need to get a picture of this. Tim just changed his background to the Matrix. It's amazing. But this is where it gets really weird. Then she goes on to say, we're talking about music and such. And she goes, you know what? Best Christian band of all time, Me Without You. I immediately was like, that is the correct answer. What?
The formula that you used was absolutely inappropriate. However, you got the correct answer.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. She starts naming off all these bands that Mike and I, and hopefully Tim, will see this fall. And I'm like, yeah, those are all great bands. She said that she had a daughter, she would have named the daughter May, like the band May. And I was just like, this is the weirdest thing. And she's like 5 or 6 years older than me. So like, even that blew me away. So yeah, that's my story, my glitch in the matrix. I met someone whose favorite Christian band was the same as mine. And they're really relatively unknown, at least in terms of like most people's musical repertoire. So anyway, mm-hmm. There's my glitch in the matrix story. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
I also have a coworker who likes Me Without You randomly. It's kind of a weird coincidence.
But you have a far more interesting job than mine.
Well,
that is true. Yeah. And it attracts far, far better looking people than mine.
Can't say I've seen anyone else at your work besides you, but like,
fair enough.
You're setting the bar. Don't worry.
Speaking of bar, I wish I could go to the bar after this recent rescript from Arthur Roach regarding Traditionis Custodes, but too bad it's Lent and I'm not drinking. So yeah, let's talk about it. What is this book? What is the whole thrust of it? And why does it matter? And why do we want to share it with our friends here at Theology of the Buddy?
Yeah, the reason I really like this book is not exactly because it says anything new per se, but just because of how it brings stuff together, lays out arguments really nicely, and kind of makes it really accessible for people to dive into this question if they have a mind to. It's only, what, 80, 81 pages, and it's laid out with Dominican rigor and quite accessibly. I think it's an easy way to kind of look into this, even if you don't have the time or inclination to read a ton of articles about canon law or church fathers or people talking about how obedience works in the church and stuff like that. Yeah, that's where I think its strength lies. And when it comes to the rescript, it doesn't really affect the primary arguments of this article. I mean, really, the rescript is just like Pope Francis and Cardinal Roach just kind of pulling strings to close loopholes, trying to say like, okay, you really need to listen to us now. But it doesn't change the central question of, is this a document, speaking of Traditionis Custodes, is this a document that is actually a legitimate law that's binding on the consciences of the faithful? And that revolves around, more than anything, it revolves around the claims in Traditionis Custodes about the nature of the Roman Rite, and not over technicalities of whether this requirement to push the trads out of your parish church is actually reserved to the Holy See, which it wasn't.
Yeah, that sums it up. I think for those who may not be 100% familiar, so this is from the book itself, but he summed it up really well. In the introduction, he states, on July 16th, 2021, the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, oh, that burns me, Pope Francis published Traditionis Custodes, an apostolic letter given motu proprio, drastically restricting the use of the traditional Roman liturgy. The use of the 1962 Missale Romanum is now subject to the authorization of the diocesan bishop, according to Article 5, who must himself consult the Holy See before granting the same to a newly ordained priest in Article 4. It is also up to the bishop to determine the days and places where the Mass may be celebrated publicly, according to the 1962 Missal, and this must, in any case, be outside parish churches, Article 3. Moreover, the bishop must be careful to not authorize the creation of any new groups, Article 3, Section 5, and even less erect new personal parishes, Article 3, Section 2. Instead, he is encouraged to verify that existing personal parishes are, quote, effective for the spiritual growth of the faithful, Article 3, Section 5. Instead of it really coming across as really intended to help the faithful, this was a very heavy hit to traditional Catholics.
Vindictive. I mean, if you got to put a label on it, it's more than a heavy hit. It is just outright vindictive, the way that they went about this. From, like, you alluded to it a moment ago, the date that they chose to release this on? Yeah. The Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Come on. The content of it. We were talking before the show about organizations treating people like family and claiming to treat people like family. Yeah. I don't have the best family, you know, from growing up, but I can tell you my family operated better than this. Yeah. What's the verse? Who asked for fish and handed stones? Yeah. This was absolutely being given stones.
Yeah. Yeah. With friends like this, who needs accompaniment?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, Mike is definitely dead on about the Dominican rigor. I know this. I believe it's Father Revoir was not a Dominican. I think he was.
He's technically not a Dominican.
Technically.
But not. He pretty much is. So
the way he laid things out, I'll 100% give him that. He's at least gotten the card.
If you know anything this about the fraternity of St. Vincent Ferrer, they're a group that they were, what's the word, SETI privationists, and then they later reconciled with Rome, and they basically have the right to use the traditional Dominican rite, although they are not considered part of the Dominican order. So they follow the Dominican tradition, but they're outside the order.
It's like, I'm not a footnotes guy, but some of these footnotes are straight fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of the 81 pages, you can probably bet that about 20 to 25 of them are footnotes. The footnotes are actually, if you didn't read the text itself and just went through the footnotes, you're going to walk away with quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think my personal favorite one was like at the end of chapter one. It's talking about the responsa from Archbishop Bernini, Roach. Sorry. And it says the sorry about that. The responsa violates canons 87, subsection 1, the right of diocesan bishops to dispense from the universal law, 902, priest rights not to concelebrate, 905, subsection 2, the possibility for any priest to binate with permission of the local ordinary, not to mention canon 213, the right of the faithful to receive the spiritual riches from their pastors, in particular the word of God and the sacraments. And 214, the right of the faithful to worship God according to the provisions of their own right and follow their own form of spiritual life in accord with the doctrine of the church. I mean, it's footnote 26 in chapter 1, and he just drops the hammer.
Yep. A running theme is like the utter lack of respect for the existing law of the church that this document has.
Oh, yeah.
Existing law. To ride over everything.
Processes. Yeah.
It's
like they were making it up as they went along when they promulgated this.
Yeah. I like what he says also in chapter one, because he also lays out the fact that a lot of people, and I've even heard priests say this, that the motu proprio is a magisterial document. And he even addresses that. He says, you know, in and of itself, a motu proprio is not an act of magisterial power, but a papal law, and therefore an act of the power of jurisdiction. I thought that was really important to lay out, you know, because it requires a different form of assent than a magisterial act. Yeah. It says here, Pope Francis, by revoking the faculties granted by his predecessors and by subjecting celebrations according to the 1962 Missal to strict conditions, intends to establish a new general, abstract, permanent, and obligatory norm, i.e. to establish a new juridical power. In so doing, he exercises his power of jurisdiction. In itself, the motu proprio traditionis custodis is formally disciplinary, not doctrinal.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people kind of treat it like it's doctrine.
Yeah. Well, it falls in line with how we've treated the Vatican II Council. And in fact, he kind of gets into that, I believe it's in chapter 2 quite a bit. You know, Vatican II Council is what it is, but it's this spirit or intention or whatever of Vatican II is given much more, almost a legislative authority that it never claimed. And then one of the things that kind of struck me while I was reading through that chapter is this tying together of Traditionis Custodis with the Mass of Paul VI. And it's like, he may have opened up a chink in the armor here, where if you are to use the same arguments against Traditionis Custodis and take it back to how the Mass of Paul VI came about, they really might be doing damage to the entire reform of Vatican II.
Mm-hmm. especially to the acts of Paul VI in imposing these new rites.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like exposing a new generation to the reality of the kind of violence of imposing these new rites on the church.
Oh, yeah. And where you have Archbishop Roach, he's tagging on with his responsa in ways that don't fall in line with the law. I mean, it violates canon law the way that he's trying to use the responsa to dictate laws that he's pulling from supposedly Traditionis Custodis that are not actually enumerated there. Mm-hmm. The same thing was done with Vatican II, where it's like, okay, Latin is gone. Gregorian chant is gone. We're changing all these different parts of the church and parts of the mass. And you're able to make these one-to-one comparisons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He really kind of hones in on that hyper-papalism, right? That's so rampant. And like he says here, you know, the Pope is not an absolute monarch whose thoughts and desires are law. On the contrary, the Pope's ministry is a guarantee of obedience to Christ and to his word.
Is that Pope Benedict?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. That is. Yep. Yeah. That's in, Pope Benedict's, one of his first homilies. He said that.
Yeah, that's such a key Benedict quote. It's very important for like understanding what's wrong with the modern view of the papacy. I wanted to focus slightly on the rationality aspect and why that's kind of the theme of this book, because it's kind of an angle you don't always see in the mainstream, and it does take a lot of like technical knowledge from someone like this, I think, to put together a good analysis of it. But it's interesting to consider the concept of law in this day and age for a lot of reasons, because from both the church and secular society, we're in a situation where we're starting to be surrounded by more and more ridiculous and unjust laws. And that's a problem as a faithful Catholic when you also know that you have a duty to obey these authorities, both secular and church authorities, but you have to put that in balance with the fact that sometimes you're being commanded to do evil, sometimes the law is trying to restrict you from doing good, and sometimes the law is just incoherent. Like the example I read the other day, and this was from a guy writing in the States, but I'm sure it's not any better up here, that basically in the American tax code, if you mow your neighbor's lawn and she gives you a jar of jam in return, you better claim the fair market value of that jam on your taxes, or you're literally a felon. Like that's the state of the ridiculousness of secular laws we're under. And the church has given us tools to analyze these. Like Aquinas has really broken open the nature of law and given it a strict set of criteria, which the church has always used. Rationality is one of them. So just to give the one sentence summary from Aquinas, the definition of a law is an ordinance of reason with a view to the common good promulgated by one who has charge of the community. Anything that attempts to be a law but doesn't pass that test is objectively not a real law and doesn't bind on the consciences of those who are bound to obey laws. So if something is, rather than being a law that's actually good for the community, a ruler does something that is for their own interest, then Aquinas describes it as a tyrannical law, a perversion of law, and basically more akin to an act of violence than an actual law. In the Summa, he basically compares rulers who make unjust laws to a robber who holds you at knife point and demands that you do what he says.
And just kind of from a personal experience, I really feel that Traditionis Custodis, when that document dropped, that was the initial reaction I had, was like, they're holding our mass at knife point.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Mm-hmm. You feel like you're completely powerless and it's so unjust.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the person who should be protecting you is lifting his sword against you, and he wants to rob you of all the good things that he is supposed to protect. So do you guys want to dive into some of the commentary on the unique expression of the Roman Rite, which I think is kind of the central claim of Traditionis Custodes, and it's also the heart of Father Rivoire's criticism of it. I would say this is where the above all, this statement in Article 1 of Traditionis Custodes is where it lacks rationality and where Father Rivoire shows it in this book.
Oh, yeah. So essentially, yeah. We're beginning with lacking of the homogenous. Can't speak tonight. Homogenous continuity.
Mm-hmm. I really liked in the book how he stacked up Article 1 of Traditionis Custodes side by side with Article 1 of Summorum Pontificum to show that they really are opposites, right? In Article 1, they claim the exact opposite thing. Article 1 of Traditionis Custodes says that the liturgical books promulgated by St. Paul VI and St. John Paul II, in conformity with the decrees of Vatican Council II, are the unique expression of the lex orandi of the Roman Rite, which, of course, stands in direct contradiction to Article 1 of Summorum Pontificum, which says the Roman Missal promulgated by Pope Paul VI is the ordinary expression of the lex orandi of the Catholic Church of the Latin Rite. The Roman Missal promulgated by St. Pius V and revised by Blessed John XXIII is nonetheless to be considered an extraordinary expression of the same lex orandi of the Church, and duly honored for its venerable and ancient usage. So it's pretty clear those are addressing the exact same topic, saying contradictory things about it. And what Father Rivoire noted about them, which I think is kind of key, is that they approach the topic with opposite intentions. Benedict's Article 1 begins from the reality that there are two separate rites claiming to be the Roman Rite, and he attempts to make the law conform to that reality and describe it, and works from there with reality as a starting point. Whereas Pope Francis, in his Article 1, basically attempts to impose his law on reality ex nihilo, just ignoring the reality and, in fact, trying to cover it up, trying to memory hole it.
Yeah, we've talked about the sense of, like, gaslighting in this pontificate, and it's so stark in this document. It makes it very clear just how much he's trying to kind of pull the wool over your eyes and make you not see what Pope Benedict he didn't declare it, because, I mean, it was already there. He just kind of brought it more to the forefront, to the light, right?
Yeah, he was declaring a law, but he declared his law based on an existing reality, right? And he didn't try to just speak the Roman Rite into existence by his authority. He just attempted to make a law that was adequate to the reality. And you can argue whether or not he succeeded at being completely adequate to the reality, but that at least was his intent, and he at least approached that, if he didn't completely succeed.
Yeah, I think that Pope Benedict definitely carries a lot of cachet in this area, if for no other reason than he was on the ground and participated in Vatican II. You know, he struggled pretty much his entire career with these questions and these ideas. You know, he was involved with the talks with the SSPX back in the 70s and 80s over, you know, what is the role of the Latin Mass. He struggled with this for decades, where he came to grips over a long period of time over what the actual reality of the role of the liturgy is. And you can see at the end of his life, at the end of his pontificate, that he's found that there is a wellspring of hope and wellspring of wisdom in tradition that you can pull from, even in the reality of a Novus Ordo Church. He didn't address it in what I would consider a perfect manner, but, you know, I've got my own biases that are going to lead me down the path that I've gone down. But I think that his honesty in the whole process, from going from being essentially a modernist, you know, wearing a suit and tie to the council, to saying the Latin Mass and wearing the fiddlebacks and embracing the traditional faithful in the ways that he did, speak volumes about him as a person and the journey that he went on. And unfortunately, I think that we don't have that kind of experience with the current pontificate.
Yeah, I think he says in that same chapter, Father Rivoire says, Pope Francis seems to be saying to traditionalists, what St. Pius V did, or once did, I do myself. Yet St. Pius V did the exact opposite of what Pope Francis claims to do in his motu proprio. Certainly, St. Pius V imposed a single Roman missal, but this was not a new missal like that of Paul VI, which Francis now claims to impose on the Latin Church. Rather, it was the ancient Roman missal restored according to the decrees of the Council of Trent, i.e. hardly altered at all from its medieval versions, end quote. I think that's true.
Another of the kind of falsehoods that are prevalent in TC and the accompanying letter, right? The idea that he's doing the same as Paul V or Pius V.
And you kind of see this, like, even in the social media sphere too, this kind of falsehood about liturgy, that Pius V kind of drew it out of whole cloth and all of that. And I mean, I think it kind of finds its roots in some of the Protestant tracts that have gone around. But yeah, I think it's wild that, I think it's weird how, you know, you see this constant lie kind of being regurgitated, you know, that a liturgy can just be drawn up by a pope and promulgated, and that's totally fine.
Mm-hmm, like out of nothing. And that Pius yeah. V did that.
Yeah.
I always think if you're really doing what Pius V did, then do the same as he did and say, if your liturgy has a history of more than 200 years, then it's untouchable. That is what Pius V said. The only liturgies he suppressed were the recent ones that he thought were potentially infected with Protestantism. He wouldn't dare to suppress an ancient liturgy. That would be insane. It is insane. So to kind of get to the bottom line on the rationality of this, I mean, it's probably pretty clear from what we have already said about it, but I think if I could summarize it, it would be that the intent by the lawgiver, especially in Article 1, to deny the truth it's at the heart of Traditionis Custodes, and above all, it's what renders it irrational. If you can pull one quote from this book that kind of summarizes the thesis, it's that, this is how Father Rivard puts it, that the legal apparatus around TC, quote, lacks rationality understood as adequacy with the reality that it claims to regulate, a reality no less than the fact of the existence in the Church of a centuries-old Roman rite substantially different from the modern rite produced by the liturgical reform of Paul VI, end quote. And that's it. You can't have a law that adequately addresses the community when it's based on a falsehood about the community or about reality itself. It's kind of like if you have a law, an obvious secular example, you have laws about abortion that are based on the idea that the unborn aren't human. Obviously, the law is unjust for a lot of reasons, but first and foremost, it's obviously unjust because it's based on a falsehood.
I think it's interesting what calling the new mass the unique expression of the Roman Rite says about how Pope Francis views what the Roman Rite is, because if you're looking at it as essentially the ecosystem of Catholicism, that's a new addition. I mean, it breaks so violently with what we have in the past that it lacks the history, it lacks the communal understanding, it lacks the philosophical underpinnings that we have with the older rites. You know, those are things that developed alongside with the rites over time. So essentially what he's viewing as the underpinnings of the expression of the unique expression of the Catholic faith or the Roman Rite. And I said that entirely wrong, but so it's a dispossessing of everything that we have in the past, including our philosophical underpinnings, and trading it out with this German and French idea of what the Church is that's developed from, you know, essentially the end of Vatican I forward, and saying, no, this is what Catholicism is. This is what the Roman Rite is. This is the idea of Catholicism as a whole. Forget everything else.
I want to try and do an analogy, and this is like off the top of my head, so if it's terrible, please don't kill me, but you can publicly shame me on the podcast. That's okay.
We'll just make bald jokes.
Yeah, that's always fair game, even if my analogy is great.
I say that as a fellow bald man.
Imagine, we've all studied Shakespeare in school, probably. Imagine you have a group that legally inherits rights to Shakespeare's plays. And they say, we're publishing a new version of Hamlet. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy because the mass is way older than Hamlet. So it's not nearly as much of an affront. But imagine someone did have the gall to say, I wrote this play from scratch. It bears a passing resemblance to Hamlet. This is now Hamlet. You have to study mine in school, not the original. And now, now they say, not only can you not study the old one, mine is the only Hamlet there has ever been. It is Hamlet.
It contains 17% of the previous Hamlet.
No matter what your legal standing, that's just a lie. And it's the same with the Roman Rite. If you write a new liturgy from scratch and just say it's this is the Roman Rite and nothing else is the Roman Rite, you're just lying. It doesn't matter if you're the Pope. It's just not true.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I don't know if you heard about recently the estate of Roald Dahl, who wrote the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach and Danny Champion of the World and a lot of great books. Yeah, the estate of Roald Dahl has given rights to the publishers to wokeify all of his works. And it completely undoes some of the really important analogies that Dahl put into his stories. You know, even though he wasn't a Christian per se, he did kind of talk about natural virtue in a roundabout way. You know, like Augustus Gloop in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you're familiar with him, right? He couldn't get his eating under control and turned into a blueberry, right? He turned really fat. So
no, that was, who was that? That was somebody else. He got stuck.
Oh, wait, is Augustus Gloop the guy that fell in?
He fell into the lake of chocolate and got sucked up into the pipes.
That's right. That's
and they
right.
Had to do like the Oompa Loompa Drano to get him out.
That's right. So like, yeah. But I mean, yeah, he couldn't.
Violet
he
couldn't Beauregard got. Yeah.
Violet Beauregard. Yeah. But in any case, he couldn't get his eating under control, and so they have to remove that because it's quote unquote anti-fat. By the way, random side note as well, the word anti-fat was just recently added into the dictionary. Anti-fat. I don't know what else to say. I just, yeah, at the end of the day, like I was saying to Julie, like we need to make sure you go to the, you know, used bookstores and get these books. You know, because the new ones will not be the original books, you know, because they're going to go through these books, especially the classics, and try to make them more palatable to a easily triggerable audience.
I was just saying the same thing to Brooke, literally about a dictionary, actually, because Evie's trying to read some books where there's a lot of words she doesn't know. And I thought, hey, she doesn't have a dictionary. We should get her like a paper dictionary because, I mean, we're so used to just looking stuff up on Google, but she doesn't have access to the internet. She is 7. So I was thinking of buying one for her, but I said to Brooke, like, we gotta buy it from a used bookstore, not from the dollar store. Because I don't want her to like look up woman and have it say anyone who identifies as a woman or like whatever dumb crap they put in. You never know, right?
I had to do the same thing with the catechism. I had to go find one that was issued prior to the changes with capital punishment.
Yeah.
So it's, unfortunately, it's something that not only are we doing, but we started the charge on it.
Yeah. Coming back to that rationality comment, in my theology class that I'm doing, they were talking about how truth is the conforming of the mind to reality, and how when you look at relativism and how prevalent it is in our culture right now, I mean, literally, you can look at a man and be told, no, you have to address that man as a cat because that's how he identifies, or whatever pronoun or whatever that he's chosen. And it's really is that turning on its head of the conforming of the mind to reality.
Yeah, it's all kind of one at that level, isn't it? It's just the strategy of the evil one on various levels.
Yeah, especially after reading this document, it really hearkened to Crescendi by Pope St. Pius X, right? Where he talks about the modernists and how they seek to set poison to the roots of the tree and it goes all the way through. And I'm just like, this is it. This is what he was warning about like over 100 years ago. The spoke of Satan really has entered by a fissure into the church. And like, if you haven't seen it before, it's in plain English in this document.
I got one more quote from this book that I wanted to highlight. I just think is interesting in kind of illuminating things in my mind. This was from page 38. He points out there's a contradiction on the part of the reformers, and I think he means in general, in the Paul VI era and also in the Francis era, in maintaining that the new rite is substantially identical to the previous one, while at the same time judging the celebration according to an earlier edition of the Missal to be abnormal or even illicit without exceptional permission.
Yeah.
How is it illicit if we're celebrating substantially the same rite? Please tell me. And he points out that there's a parallel to Pius V here, right? Because, I mean, it was a low-tech time, so there wasn't the internet, but Pius V was not out, like, banging down your door, sending his attack dog to stop you from saying your Sarum rite or your Dominican rite or whatever rite you were saying in the years after the council. It was a steady process of people receiving the teaching and getting new books, switching over to the Roman rite. And it was something that was done willingly by the faithful bishops. And it wasn't like a harsh legalistic imposition where the Pope is accusing you of disobedience and division if you have your own local rite. It's a very different kind of a very different rollout of these masses.
Well, yeah, and Revoir talks about the vacatio legis, right? The time where the law is proposed and then the time frame to implement it, right? This, with Traditionis Custodis, it was treated as if this was a matter of grave importance and it needed to be implemented yesterday, you know, like, but it was so heavy-handed, like all the bishops, like, and it came out in the middle of the summertime. A number of them were sitting on the dock eating, you know, eating Cheetos and like hanging out. They didn't have the ability or the time to implement this, you know? But yeah, Rome came down so harshly with this and gave them no time frame to implement it.
It just kind of shows the absurdity, right? It's like if one extra Latin mass is said, then there's going to be irreversible damage to the church. Even as he pointed out in the book, Summorum Pontificum had a delay of like several months before it came into effect, even though it's not asking you to actually stop anything that you're currently doing. It doesn't impose any onerous burden on anyone.
Yeah. That just went into that whole sense of we're being attacked right now. And yeah, feeling that knife to the neck. It was very sudden.
When you help someone, you let them know you're coming. You give them warning. You help them in like a gentle, approachable way. When you attack someone, you hit them where it hurts when they least expect it.
Yeah, so much for the church of accompaniment. The one thing that I found interesting with this book is that it really did end on a high note, though. For all the doom and gloom that went through the book itself, it ended on a high note. Did you want to talk?
It's an idea that has been kind of floated in a couple articles I've seen since Traditionis Custodes, but he put it really well in this book too. Well, basically the idea that we alluded to how Pope Benedict had approached the reality of the two forms claiming to be the Roman Rite, and either approached it rationally and done his best to impose a law that was acceptable to all the faithful and that adequately described the reality. And he did a good job, but not a perfect job, I would say. One of the potential ways that you could see Traditionis Custodes being used for good in the plan of divine providence is that it basically gets rid of the idea of the two forms of the Roman Rite and opens us up to, in the future, having a law that describes the reality more accurately, I would say. And the obvious suggestion is to actually admit that the Roman Rite and the modern Rite are separate rites, not just two expressions of the Roman Rite.
And he really does kind of set out the fact that this is possible. So yeah, it's something that obviously we should all be praying for. I think that the church would come to that realization and free the liturgy and all of the traditional sacraments and all of that. Because, yeah, I mean, you can't just give us back the Mass and say, you know, fair deal, good compromise. We need it all back. We need the traditional sacraments. We need the minor orders. We need all of that back.
Mm-hmm. Especially the baptisms, the confirmations, mm-hmm. the ordination of priests.
Marriages. Yeah.
The divine office.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. There's one thing that I've been thinking about that he addresses in this, and that this is not necessarily just an attack on the traditional faithful, but this is actually also an attack on the limited autonomy that the bishops have. That for as much as Pope Francis challenges to promote synodality and, you know, accompaniment and, you know, a decentralization process, this is actually a massive power grab, because he's taking something that is the purview of the bishops, or several things that are the purview of the bishops, you know, the ability to dispense from universal law. He's, you know, pulling that back. The ability for bishops to dictate the liturgies that are available in their diocese. And okay, the bishops can do this, but with the authorization of Rome. And so it's not only just an attack on the faithful, but it really is an attack on the, like I said, the limited autonomy that the bishops do have, and really centralizes the power rather than having the decentralized synodical model that he's been pushing for, at least in word. Indeed, he's actually centralizing and taking that power to himself.
Absolutely.
sorry.
Yeah, it's...
This is what happens when you throw somebody in the middle of a room with ADHD.
No, that's an important point, too. Like, honestly, that part is something to me that gives me hope in the positive outcomes as we progress years and decades away from Traditionis Custodes, because it's apparent, even from a layman's perspective, that bishops are not climbing over each other to implement Traditionis Custodes. They don't want it, except for a few extremists who are really in the Francis Club. Most bishops do not want this. It's a pain for them. It gets them into fights. It unsettles things that they had settled down. And it creates a ton of work for them. And I think a lot of them can see, even if they have no interest in saying the Latin Mass and aren't really traditionalists by any stretch, I think they can see that this is not a move that promotes the Catholic faith in any way. They can see that it's something that tears the church down. So they don't want it.
Right. Yep. Like Bishop Tobin, right? He said on Twitter on February 21st, he said, "The way the Vatican is dealing with the traditional Latin Mass does not seem to me to be the quote-unquote style of God. Pope Francis himself has emphasized that those who are attached to the TLM should be, quote, accompanied, listened to, and given time." End quote.
Yeah, so much for that.
Yeah. Bishop Poprocki from Springfield, Illinois called it out too recently, saying like TLM Catholics are good Catholics.
Yeah, I saw that too. He's been on fire lately.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say part of the running theme of just talking out both sides of your mouth that kind of pervades the document itself and pervades that aspect of it too. It's just everywhere.
Yeah.
It puts good bishops in bad positions, because bishops that care for their flock care for their entire flock. And that includes traditionalists. That includes even the opposite extreme, where you've got Catholics who are essentially Catholic in name only. They're bishops that bish for everybody. And this puts those bishops in a position where they can't reach out to a significant portion of their flock. And thank you to COVID, traditionalism has become much more of a significant portion of the population than it used to be. During the lockdown, churches were exploding at the seams. The ones that were having the traditional mass, where they just said, no, we're not closing. You know, they had people out the door, or, you know, just filling fields wherever they were having mass. Numbers were doubling and tripling quickly. And that has, in what I've seen, largely been maintained. From what I've seen of the Novus Ordo parishes around here, yeah, there's still a good number of people who've come back, but it's not like it was. And, you know, for the traditional parishes, it's not like it was either, but it's not like it was for a totally different reason.
Oh, yeah. You see it in our community, even though our diocesan Latin Mass wasn't actually open during COVID, but even the limited amount that we were able to resist some of the nonsense going on within the purview of a diocesan place. We've, since COVID, how much have we gone up? Like 50% more.
According to Vox Cantoris, our community has increased since June 2020. We have gone up 204%.
My goodness.
Yeah. Not bad.
That's statistically ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking a period of 2.5 years, almost 3 years now.
And yeah. Add to that the fact that our local SSPX is building a new chapel because they can't fit in it anymore. Mm. They were the ones that were actually open more than us.
Yeah.
Even though with the Canadian government, they couldn't get away with being open all the time. But
they did what they could.
You want to talk about a group that upped their stock during the lockdown? The SSPX changed some minds and hearts.
Yeah,
really. A lot of people, you know, getting into those chapels and experiencing it firsthand, there's a drastic difference from some of the people I've talked to from their position beforehand, where they were very much in the either on the fence or worse for the SSPX. But it became a point of necessity where it's like, we've got to do something. So they go to these chapels that are set up around, and all of a sudden, you know, they're realizing, hey, this reality that I thought is what it was, that's not the case. They're not going in there and hearing homilies that are just militantly anti-modernist, but they're solidly Thomistic. They're going in and they're experiencing tradition firsthand and seeing, like, this is true, this is good, and this is beautiful. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And that, and honestly, is if you give it a few weeks, it really sells itself. And fortunately for, you know, the church, COVID gave that time that was needed for a lot of people to experience it firsthand, and, you know, where it was the only show in town.
Yep. Yeah. You know, talking about Bishop Paprocki, I just wanted to read this too. I think this was really pertinent. And I don't mean to derail things, Mike. If you want to just cut it off, you can. But he talked about the rescript that came from Cardinal Roach and said, I question the wisdom of the rescript under the principle of subsidiarity. The bishop said, this is from a CNA article. He said, subsidiarity suggests that these decisions are made usually at a local level. Because there had been already rumors that the Vatican would centralize authority in this matter, Paprocki preempted the rescript by taking additional action to ensure that Traditionis Custodis would not affect any of the Latin masses within his diocese. In January 2022, Paprocki formally redesignated Sacred Heart in Springfield as a non-parochial church or non-parish church. He was able to do this because the parish, St. Catherine Drexel Parish, already had two churches. In quote, just to remove any doubt, I was able to redesignate that church, Paprocki said. That took care of Sacred Heart Church. So there are priests that are just like, or bishops that are playing it incredibly smart, like Bishop Paprocki.
That's a nice move.
That kind of kindness is so rare.
Our bishop could easily do that for us if he wanted to, because we have parish clusters in like every parish, basically. So he could easily take one of those buildings. I don't even know if they all count as parish churches anymore because of how they're clustered. Let's end on that note of courage and charity from Bishop Paprocki, and we'll give our message to the listeners in union with all the good bishops.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everybody for listening to today's podcast. We'd love to know your thoughts on Traditionis Custodis, on the rescript, on the status of your Latin Mass and your diocese. Let us know. You can hit us up on Facebook or DM on Instagram at Theology of the Buddy. You can find us on Twitter at Stay Traddy, or you can email us at theologyofthebuddy@gmail.com. Now that we have recently switched over to Anchor, we also have a really cool new feature. So you can find us at anchor.fm/theologyofthebuddy. And there is a way on that website now to leave us a voice message. So if you want to leave us a voice message, we'd love to hear from you, and we'll include it in the podcast if you'd like us to do that. So again, that's anchor.fm/theologyofthebuddy, or just theologyofthebuddy@gmail.com. You can find us there. Also, if you are listening to us on iTunes or Spotify, please, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review. It would really help us out, and it helps to get us noticed within the wider podcast community. All right. So the next episode, I believe, is going to be another liturgical breakdown. We hope that you will join us for that. We're going to be continuing our discussion about the Roman canon, and it's going to be great. So yeah, make sure you're subscribed so you know when that comes out. Yeah, make sure you're subscribed so you can receive a notification when it goes live. All right, and from all of us here to all of you,
stay tratty.